The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen, and we thank them for their support. Today we're reading for the first time the November 2021 edition. And I don't usually read the cover, but the cover says, "There's no place like Mars." And we'll assume that some of the stories are related to space travel or the like. Welcome to Mars. A photographer documents her two-week mission to a research facility on the Big Island of Hawaii, where people are studying How to Live on the Red Planet, by Cassandra Kloss. And as expected, here's the article, Welcome to Mars, and it's a fisheye lens look at the hostile landscape, cramped quarters, dehydrated food. A photographer takes part in experiments to live on another planet. Photographs by Cassandra Kloss, text by Jenny Rothenberg-Greitz. When Cassandra Kloss was growing up in rural New Hampshire, it was easy to see the stars. She traced the constellations with her finger and imagined how it would feel to travel among them. As a college art student, she launched a photo project about Betty and Barney Hill, a New Hampshire couple who claimed to have been abducted by aliens. Then Kloss went on her first mission to Mars. To be clear, no Earthling has actually set foot on the Red Planet. NASA is hoping to send a crew there in the 2030s, as is China, and the private company SpaceX is working to establish a permanent Martian presence with starships ferrying humans back and forth to Earth. "We don't want to be one of those single-planet species," SpaceX founder Elon Musk said in April, outlining the company's ambitions. "We want to build a multi-planet species. First, though, there's some figuring out to do. Designing the right spacecraft and living spaces is part of the challenge. There are also prosaic but important questions. How will people shower with a limited supply of water? What will it take to grow fresh greens to supplement the steady diet of dehydrated food? And with civilians from different backgrounds living together in close quarters, will Martian habitats end up resembling the set of Jean-Paul Sartre's play No Exit, where hell is other people?" The two-week mission Kloss joined in 2015 was designed to explore those kinds of questions. It took place at the Mars Desert Research Station in Utah, 4 hours south of Salt Lake City. But everyone spoke and acted as though they were actually on Mars. A group of 6 people lived in a 2-story cylindrical building. The commander, a former member of the Army National Guard, kept participants on a strict schedule of fixing electrical systems, taking inventory, tidying up the facilities, and sampling the soil. Everyone was assigned a special role. Kloss's was to prepare reports to share with the public. The health safety officer kept tabs on the crew's well-being. The engineer monitored levels of carbon dioxide and solar power. Before stepping out in a spacesuit, Kloss and the others had to get permission from Mission Control back on Earth, Earth in air quotes, actually a coordinator stationed in a nearby town. That person would send information about the winds and weather and determine how long each person could stay outside the base. Sometimes dust storms rolled in, cutting off the solar power supply, just as they would on Mars. Kloss was allowed to bathe only once a week, using a couple of buckets of water. She was enchanted. "This is not performance art," says Kloss. "These are real scientific endeavors. Sometimes people make the critique that we're role-playing too much, but the goal is to really live the way people are going to live on Mars so scientists can figure out how to make it work when we get there. There are about a dozen such habitats around the globe. hosting simulations that run anywhere from 2 weeks to a full year. One of these is run by NASA's Human Research Program at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, but other facilities are funded by private organizations. The Mars Society, established by Brooklyn-born aerospace engineer Robert Zubrin, operates the Habitat in Utah, where Kloss returned for another mission in 2017 and another in the Canadian Arctic. Kloss also took part in a mission at the Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation, or High Seas, HISEAS. The facility is run by the International Moon Base Alliance, a group formed by the Dutch entrepreneur Henk Rogers. High Seas is located on Hawaii's Big Island at 8,200 feet above sea level, on top of the active volcano Mauna Loa. NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center is collaborating with the facility to gather information about volcanic caves and the microbes that live in those Mars-like conditions. High Seas is also studying the limitations of doing that kind of work while wearing heavy spacesuits. It's hard enough for astronauts to hold a screwdriver in a gloved hand while repairing the International Space Station. But people are going to be clamoring on Martian rocks looking for microbes. They'll need the right gear. The missions are open to people who have no background in science, engineering, or astronaut training. After all, the goal is to send ordinary folks into space. So it's worth finding out whether ordinary folks can coexist in a Mars-like condition here on Earth. Each two-story habitat at a simulation facility has usable floor space of only about 1,200 square feet, the size of two small apartments stacked on top of each other, which isn't much room for six people who can't just breeze out for a walk around the block. To get a spot on Mars or Moon simulation, you have to propose a project that the leaders believe is useful. One recent High Seas participant focused on 3D printing, looking at ways to create bricks out of volcanic rock. Another studied hydrogen fuel cells. Yet another tried out different methods for growing hydroponic lettuce. Many projects focused on psychological research, looking at how various foods, exercises, and smells influence people's mood while they're crammed together in a pressurized capsule. Preparations for Mars may prove to have benefits for life on Earth. Earlier research for space travel paved the way for medical advances such as magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI. The data we're gathering now about surviving on solar power, conserving water, and growing plants in arid conditions could be useful here at home as our climate changes. The director of High Seas, the 32-year-old astrobiologist Michaela Musilova, says she makes an effort to assemble diverse crews using the Internet to recruit teachers, journalists, and artists like Kloss. On a mission Musilova led in the fall of 2020, she ended up with crew members who supported opposing candidates in the November presidential election. That made for very interesting dynamics, she says. But Musilova says her teams are most innovative when their members come from different backgrounds. The range of perspectives is great for problem solving, and the variety of personal stories can help combat boredom. And people who are eager to spend time on Mars, simulated or otherwise, tend to have certain things in common, including a willingness to live with strangers in close quarters and an enthusiasm for future space explorations. We all have our quirks, Musilova says. We're all going to make mistakes and annoy other people. But when someone is having a bad day, we go out of our way to cheer them up. When someone is being a pain in the you-know-what, we're able to have some empathy. If living together on Mars can make us into better versions of ourselves, that might be the greatest breakthrough of all. Here are some of the captions to various pictures. Karen Rucker looks up at the inside of a lava tube during a spacewalk. The deep caves resemble the terrain that likely awaits human explorers on Mars. And you see her, she looks like she's in a cave with a light on her helmet. Another page, they look like they're on a faraway planet. Crew members are caught outside in changing weather, a stand-in for a Martian dust storm. They abort their research and radio the habitat to coordinate a safe return. Knee pads are part of the gear participants wear as they explore volcanic terrain. The scuffs reflect the sharpness of the landscape around the habitat. Crew members don spacesuits. Although they breathe normally on their excursions, they wear the type of life support systems they need on Mars. The high seas habitat at the top of Mauna Loa, with another volcano, Mauna Kea, in the distance, the solar panel on the left provides most of the electricity for the mission. A timer and countdown clock located within the airlock keep track of compression levels inside the habitat. Space-suited crewmates often communicate using signals borrowed from scuba divers. A hand on the head indicates that all is well. This gesture also happens to cast a shadow that resembles the alien in E.T. Lindsay Rudder examines a volcanic rock. She's studying tiny organisms that live in such environments and may have Martian counterparts. Fabio Teixeira works on weather experiments. On days when solar power is scarce, the blue glow of the control system is the only light source in the habitat. In another one, shelf-stable grains and dehydrated produce make up most of the crew's diet. Instant hot chocolate is always in high demand. Michaela Masilova, center, helps participants plan spacewalks, listing the times they'll be gone and the GPS coordinates of places they intend to explore. Ben Greaves analyzes microgreen and herb samples. He's experimenting with a substance called hydrogel, which absorbs humidity from the atmosphere. Staying fit in confinement is a crucial part of every mission. When humans travel to Mars, the 300 million mile journey will take at least 7 months. The habitat and experiments at high seas are designed to prepare humankind for a permanent presence on the moon as well as for Mars missions. And the last, Musilova makes her way down a steep lava tube, followed by Karen Rucker and Greaves. Musilova has been conducting NASA research at various lava tube locations for many months. And I hope you found that interesting. Here's a couple short stories. Ancient amethyst ring found in Israel may have been worn to ward off hangovers. Found near a Byzantine-era winery, the jewelry likely belonged to a wealthy, high-status individual. By Livia Gershon. Archaeologists in Israel have discovered an amethyst and gold ring dated as far back as the 7th century, and possibly much earlier. The team found the ring in Yavne, Y-A-V-N-E, south of Tel Aviv in central Israel, at a site that was home to a huge winemaking operation during the Byzantine era, reports Stuart Weiner for the Times of Israel. The location is particularly striking given the ancient lore regarding amethysts. Many virtues have been attached to this gem, including the prevention of the side effect of drinking, the hangover, says Amir Golani, an archaeologist with the Israel Antiquities Authority, IAA, in a statement. Researchers made the find near a warehouse used to store wine at the production facility, reports Rosella Terkaten for the Jerusalem Post. They were able to date the landfill where it was unearthed to the 7th century, a tumultuous time when the Byzantine Empire lost control of the region to Arab Muslim forces. ETZ's Ruth Schuster writes, That's some kind of publication. It's generally impossible to directly date inorganic objects like metal and gems through methods like carbon dating. Similar gold bands with inlaid amethysts were common in the Roman world and may have been worn by a member of Yavin's elite as early as the 3rd century. By the 7th century, the ring found at the winery could have been an heirloom handed down over many generations. Both men and women wore similar rings. Whoever owned the jewelry would have been a person of wealth and high status. Finding an ancient ring with a semi-precious stone intact is rare, Golani tells Anshel Pfeiffer of the London Times. Its size and ostentatiousness indicates it belonged to someone who wanted to flaunt their wealth. In the statement, archaeologist Eli Hadid, a co-director of the IAA excavation, says, "It is possible that the splendid ring belonged to the owner of the magnificent warehouse, to a foreman, or simply to an unlucky visitor who dropped and lost their precious ring until it was finally discovered by us." The IAA has been conducting large-scale excavations at Yavne ahead of a construction project. In addition to the winemaking facility, they found artifacts including a colorful 1,600-year-old mosaic and an intact 1,000-year-old chicken egg, which researchers subsequently broke by mistake. Last year, teenage volunteers working on a dig in the city discovered a trove of hundreds of coins from 1,100 years ago. For Harzitz, the word amethyst comes from the Greek word amethios, meaning not intoxicating, and is related to medhu, M-E-D-H-U, meaning mead, which is a type of wine. Ancient Greeks sometimes incorporated amethysts into wine glasses or wore the gems while drinking in hopes of avoiding intoxication. The connection between amethysts and sobriety dates back at least to the time of the Greek poet Asclepiades of Samos, who was born around 320 BC. And mention the phenomenon in a poem according to the Gemological Association of Great Britain. Because of their blood-like hues, amethysts, like rubies, were believed in the ancient world to contain energy and healing powers, Golani tells the Times. Livia Gershon is a daily correspondent for Smithsonian. She is also a freelance journalist based in New Hampshire. She has written for JSTOR Daily and The Daily Beast, The Boston Globe, Huffington Post, and Vice, among others. Up next, holding cell for gladiators, doomed prisoners found at Roman amphitheater in England. Researchers initially thought the structure was a passageway to the ancient arena. By David Kindy, K-I-N-D-Y, Daily Correspondent. Nearly 2,000 years ago, Roman gladiators doomed prisoners and wild animals anxiously awaited their fate in a small room at the Richborough Amphitheatre in southeastern England. Now, reports Jack Malvern for the London Times, archaeologists have identified the ruins of this ancient carcer, C-A-R-C-E-R, or holding cell. The cell and other finds made at the settlement, including animal bones, pottery, and coins, speak to Richborough's importance in Roman Britain, says Paul Pattison, senior properties historian at English Heritage, in a statement. Initially settled in the 1st century, the site remained in use until the end of Roman rule in 410. Continuing, the discoveries we've made during the excavation at Richborough are startling and exciting and dramatically transform our understanding of the structure of the amphitheater and the nature of adjacent settlement in the town, Patterson adds. We've always known that the Roman fort at Richboro was an important place to the Romans, and now we have been able to gather evidence that much of the town outside the fort may also have been settled before the very end, or until the very end. Known as the Rutupus, Richboro was where Roman troops first landed during the conquest of Britain in 43, the year 43. According to English Heritage, the site became a resupply base for Roman legions and eventually a civilian settlement with a large fort. As Richboro is coastal, it would have provided a connection between what was at the time Britannia and the rest of the Roman Empire. Patterson tells Hannah Ryan of CNN, and because of that, all sorts of Romans who came from all corners of the empire would have passed through and lived in the settlement. In addition to the amphitheater, archaeologists have discovered the ruins of a triumphal arch and other structures in and around Richboro. Made of chalk and turf, the amphitheater was large enough to seat 5,000 spectators. And entertainment? It would have hosted public spectacles and entertainment, such as wild animals, hunts, executions, and gladiatorial combat. This year's dig revealed that the stadium's walls were made of mortared chalk blocks that were plastered and painted in red, yellow, black, and blue, a rarity for Roman amphitheaters in Britain. They probably originally contained painted scenes, perhaps figurative scenes of what happens in amphitheaters, Patterson tells Harriet Sherwood of The Guardian. We don't have that detail yet, but we have the paint, and that's a really good start. Given that we've only excavated a tiny fragment of the wall, it bodes well for better preserved painted scenes elsewhere around the circuit. Archaeologists have known about the room, now believed to be a cursor, since 1849. As the Times explains, experts originally thought the space was a passageway to the arena. Upon searching the room's foundations during the recent excavation, however, they realized that the 6-foot-tall stone walls had just one opening, an exit for those destined to appear in the stadium. If you let your imagination run riot, then it is spooky to stand in there, Patterson tells the Times. You can imagine what it's like. Once you know what sort of things happen there, it is quite emotive. You can imagine the worst aspects of Roman life. Researchers have discovered a trove of artifacts during the dig, which began in mid-September and is set to conclude this month. Finds include butchered animal bones, coins, personal items, pottery fragments, and the skeleton of a cat. Archaeologists nicknamed the nearly intact feline Maxipus, reports BBC News. Little is known about the bones, except that they were purposefully buried outside the amphitheater in the domestic section of the settlement. Normally, you would expect it to have been dismembered by predators, but it's almost complete, so it looks like it was deliberately placed where it wasn't disturbed, says Patterson to The Guardian. Archaeologists with English Heritage and Historic England collaborated on the recent excavation. They plan to display some of the new discoveries in the refurbished museum at the Richboro Roman Fort and Amphitheater next summer. David Kindy is a daily correspondent for Smithsonian. He's also a journalist, freelance writer, and book reviewer who lives in Plymouth, Massachusetts. He writes about history, culture, and other topics for Air and Space, military history, World War II, Vietnam, aviation history, Providence Journal, and other publications and websites. And our final story, how does wildfire smoke affect the movement and communication of bees? Asks Valerie Townsley of French Gulch, California. Bees use the sun to orient themselves and communicate their locations to others. When the sunlight gets polarized by smoke, bees become disoriented. The threat is even worse for domesticated honeybees who live in above-ground hives and can't hunker underground the way wild bees can. They're also loyal subjects. Honeybees will not relocate if fire approaches because the queen is typically incapable of flight at that stage of hive development, says Floyd Shockley, an entomologist at the Natural History Museum. And they will not abandon their queen. If the wooden frame of their beehive catches fire, the bees will be consumed along with it. And one more from Ask Smithsonian. What is the earliest record of humans thinking about an afterlife? Asks Hannah Long of Saltillo, Mississippi. Written records are full of beliefs about the afterlife, from reincarnation to resurrection, but they date back only about 5,000 years at most. There's no way of knowing prehistoric people's thoughts. Beliefs do not fossilize, says Rick Potts, a paleontologist who directs the Smithsonian's Human Origins Program. Starting between 100,000 and 130,000 years ago, Homo sapiens, living in what is now Israel, buried people with items like animal bones, seashells, and ochre pigment, perhaps because they thought the deceased could use those items in the next world. But these relics might simply show that early humans honored and grieved their loved ones. Sometimes other primates, like chimpanzees, have also been shown to do. And I think we can sneak in one more story. How do snails get their shells? Asks Peter Ramirez of Gladstone, Oregon. All mollusks build their own shells, whether they live in water or on land. Creatures like snails, clams, oysters, and mussels use an organ called a mantle to secrete layers of calcium carbonate, which crystallize and harden. Mollusks have a physical bias toward the right, just as most humans are right-handed, and this makes their shells spiral clockwise. Very rare mutations can produce left-handed mollusks, whose shells spiral counterclockwise. These coiled shells are compact and have a low center of gravity, making them efficient to carry as they protect their soft-bodied inhabitants from predators and, in the case of ocean mollusks, from tides and waves. Mollusks stay in the same shell for their entire lives and never stop adding to them, though they add less and less as they age. It's like each shell is a snail's autobiography, says Jerry Hasowick, curator emeritus at the National Museum of Natural History. Hey, and that's going to wrap us up for sure today. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. Address any comments or questions to us at 919-832-5138.